Okay, I think we're on time today. We've got good technology. We've got electricity. And so I'm delighted to see many familiar faces. This is the 3rd of August, 2011. I'm Joe Bach, and this is our third session on violence prevention. So I was able, when the electricity came back on, to download some maps of what we've been talking about today. Not this map, but a different one related to Haiti that we'll get into later. But I'm real happy to see that we've got electricity so that we can use this camera as well. So this is a map that we had a little bit of a struggle yesterday looking over. I just wanted to go through this real quickly so that we've got kind of a geographical sense of the different types of examples that we'll be referring to. Sri Lanka is just south of India. Some of my arrows aren't real exact here, but as you can see, this is where India is at. This is the island of Sri Lanka, also called Ceylon, particularly by devout Buddhists. This is India, and over here is where Ahmedabad is at. Another place that we'll be talking about. It's in the state of Gujarat, and that's Ahmedabad is the town from which Gandhi launched the protest against the British salt law. Democratic Republic of Congo is in here, and Rwanda is here. Kenya over here. The Horn of Africa is this region of Africa, it's often called. You can see the little horn there. Sometimes people refer to some of the countries in there as the Great Lakes region of Africa, not to be confused with Lake Michigan. Of course, we've been talking about Egypt and Tunisia, which is right up in here. And then it's interesting to note that Libya is right in the middle. So it's a great example of when there has been an effort to do a nonviolent political transition, which has minimal violence, as compared to the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people losing their lives in Libya. I did check, there was an article in The Economist that I was just talking with Dick about that confirms that at least from the time that it was published in July, the count was about 800 people in Egypt who have been killed in the political transition, a little over 200 in Tunisia. Minimal compared to what you see in Libya now. Okay, and then we'll have, we talked about ethnic cleansing in the Balkans, and that's, of course, in Eastern Europe. Over here, we'll be talking about gang violence in Chicago, where many of you know where that's at, and Philadelphia, where, again, we'll be talking about, gang violence as well as the wider issue of crime in Philadelphia. We talked about this theory of public health and basically the approaches that are used for these goals, with the indicator being a reduction in the level of violence. This is the theory of what you could call an applied theory of change of the ceasefire project in Chicago. And it's a really useful one. It affirms a lot of the things that David Horowitz had brought up in his analytical framework, particularly the need for involving the community to change the expectations of, is violence acceptable or not? Is this just a way of life? Can we just learn to live with it? And also the idea of increasing the risk of becoming violent and widening their alternatives of what to do. I'm sorry, what is your name?
Rich.
Rich. Rich, you brought up some good examples of how people feel they really can't get out of gangs. And they remove tattoos, for instance, so that they're able to get out of this peer group pressure that can be quite violent if people try to leave the group. We talked about this, particularly because we're here at Holden Village and a lot of us are motivated on the basis of our faith. And it's important to keep in mind that religion is both something that is oftentimes used to propel violence or to facilitate violence. At the same time, it's often used in ways that bring about reconciliation, greater understanding of people. But the important thing that the research shows, remember, this is what this friend of mine, Rick McCauley, who's at Bryn Mawr College in the Pennsylvania area, we call this co-religionist gatekeeping. In other words, gatekeeping of the religious, the theology, the doctrine, maintain fidelity to that rather than extracting extremist clauses from a religion. So moderates engage with extremists of different religious traditions. In this case, I had in mind India, so it would have been Hindu, Muslim, Christian. Moderates engaging with extremists. The moderates knowing each other so that they can communicate a perception of aggression, but the interaction between to try to mitigate the violence is with co-religionists. It's not interfaith, it's intrafaith. Okay, these are the technologies that we're going to try to get through today, and some of them are relatively straightforward, relatively easy to understand. Many of you know what community organizing is about. Those of you from Chicago are familiar with Saul Alinsky and the Industrial Areas Foundation. He wrote a book years ago called Rules for Radicals. He talked about a rather confrontive approach to community organizing. The discipline of social work has a different kind of perspective of community organizing that involves really helping people to develop an organization within their neighborhood or community so that they can have a collective voice and bring about positive change. So community organizing is what we will see was the major approach used in Ahmedabad, India. And then in Sri Lanka, we'll be talking about the use of events data. And I started working with this group in Sri Lanka in 2004 along with the Asia Foundation that is based in San Francisco. And they sent me to Sri Lanka in 2004 to help an organization called Foundation for Coexistence. And there I saw how they developed events data, and we'll talk about other approaches that are being used right now. And then how they assigned weights to events data so that some kinds of events are more symbolically potent than others. And so what they do is that they add weights mathematically, and we'll talk about that. The importance of verifying that an event actually happened, and then adding location to it and putting it up on a digital map is something that the journalists in Kenya in the post-election violence in 2008 did using Google Earth. Phenomenal development that's just blossomed in applications all over the world, including in crisis mapping circumstances such as the relief effort in Haiti. And I'm going to be showing you a map of that relief effort that I just pulled off of the internet when the electricity came back on. And then there's a very challenging area of how to send warnings and to whom do you send warnings. You don't necessarily want to send a message to people or call people that there's going to be violence because you can cause panic, hysteria, etc. You, in a sense, you might want to contact the police, the army, depending on a peacekeeping force, UN peacekeeping force. Or you might want to contact people whom you have trained, who know what they're doing. You probably don't want to send it to the so-called crowd of people in the area, okay? And then we'll talk a little bit, and please don't be intimidated by this, but we will talk a little bit about different approaches that are really artificial intelligence approaches that people are starting to use. And it's fascinating, but I won't spend too much time on it, okay? Okay, here is an example And the reason I bring this up, these are events data, okay? Data about events is nothing other than categorizing something that happens and then creating a code for it. So here, these were the ones that were used verbatim in India using the Ushahidi platform. They call it a platform. And if you're interested, you can look up, you can look this up. You just Google Ushahidi. It's a Swahili word. U-S-H-A-H-I-D-I. Their website is ushahidi.com. And on there they have the platform where you can post events data onto a digital map. And it's free, it's downloadable, it's a shareware product. And they have people all over the world improving it. And the people in India in the 2010 elections used the Ushahidi platform to track how the election was going. Was there corruption? Was there bribery? You can see the various dimensions that they were looking at. For instance, FORG was the code they used for forged vote. Hate speech, inflammatory speech, hate. You can see these violence, V-I-O-L. The reason they break these down to four letters is because people are using their cell phones. Yes?
Who was using this? I happened to be in India during the 2010 elections.
Okay.
And at least for public, it wasn't really communicated.
Okay. That's a great question. What they do is one of the biggest challenges is getting people to understand what's going on and how to use it. And so sometimes, I believe in India, they distributed a brochure, a flyer, that told people what the categories were and why it was important to enter this information. A lot of times it's also picked up on email that goes viral or on blogs.
Okay.
You know how viral... Go ahead.
I was in Bihar,
uh-huh.
In a little area, so there's newspapers, but not...
Okay.
And there are phones. People text a lot.
Yeah. Sometimes people spread the news by texting. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So a lot of these, you know, it's typically really young people who are really so-called plugged into new media and that sort of thing. But sometimes it's very, you know, very simple. A brochure is passed around and that sort of thing.
So it wasn't just NGO staff. It was actually...
No, it's actually the people. And
people
that's why they
reporting if they
right reporting what they see. So that's the really important point here. It was the crowd. It wasn't the NGO staff. It was the so-called crowd. And that's why they call this crowdsourcing. They're sourcing events data from people who are bystanders. They are voluntary participants with virtually no training. All they've got is a list of these codes. Right? And then they send the data in to a central place with the idea that they are part of a group of people who want to make the election fair and they want to minimize the violence related to it, etc.
It sounds great. Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't hear of it, but it's
really, really good question. No, it's, you know, I was down in Haiti for 2 months after the earthquake. And there was a blog that had been, or a website that had been developed by Ushahidi, and I didn't know it. And I was working with UN people, international NGOs. It were the Haitians themselves who pulled it together,
mm-hmm.
And which is really a phenomenal thing, in my opinion. So here are examples. If you can see, again, Vote Report India. These are examples of actual text messages that were sent in. Remember, we talk about social media all the time. We think of Twitter, Facebook, like in the event that we had last evening, those of you who came to it. A lot of what's being done to prevent violence involves texting, text messages. Okay? These are text messages.
What does it mean?
So, okay, so this one's saying that they use this in the title to try to you know, so that it's picked up by the people working on the digital map. This one, there's a bribe of liquor and clothes being distributed in this slum by a candidate. I'm sure the candidate's name was here. They took that out on their website. And that's a big problem, frankly, with a lot of this public information that's out in the public. You can get people in trouble. So you've got to be really careful with what you actually post. A lot of this isn't posted anywhere. Or if it is, it's in a sense sanitized so that location data and names are taken out so that people don't get put into a compromised position. So this was an eyewitness account of bribery that was occurring in a slum, of getting people to go vote for a candidate, as an example. So that's events data, right? So let's talk about weighing events data. And a lot of this is really subjective. There are statistical techniques that you can use, but a lot of people who do this kind of thing, they pull together focus groups. Okay? And in a lot of places where there are where there is violence, they will get people together and they'll say, okay, what about their, you know, you've got workers' harassment as compared to a political assassination. What's the difference in terms of emotional potency? And so what they do, I mean, it's a very simple thing. It's a worker being harassed. Let's say in the case of Rwanda, a Hutu worker being harassed. The weight of that is one. It's kind of a normal event. It's not that unusual. It happens pretty often. The weight on that is one. A political assassination, in contrast, the weight on that might be 50 or 100. Do you see what I'm saying? It's like a multiplier on the event. The weight of it is greater. And again, this isn't a super scientific thing, although there are statistical methods based on probability theory where they derive the weights. It's pretty simple when you just ask people in small groups what's more symbolically potent. So obviously in Rwanda, when the president's plane goes down and it's allegedly a plot, that was at least a 100 weight because it was the beginning of the genocide, right? So weighting is not this really mysterious thing. It's a relatively straightforward way of trying to take into account the impact of different events. Yes?
Speaking of weighting for the EEI, wouldn't it be possible for a corrupt politician to text "all went well" a million times?
Right.
And then how do you corroborate that? Is there a statistical way that you can eliminate false positives, false negatives, false weighting?
Okay.
Or conversely, say negative things, yes, about their opponent.
Yeah.
Right. That's one of the biggest criticisms of these systems. I really want to urge you all to keep asking questions because you're bringing out exactly what some of the concerns are.
In Bihar? It's known for corruption.
Right.
There are some people that are, there's also some truth to that.
Right.
And I was staying with in-laws who are voting.
Okay.
Who can vote,
they're
citizens.
Uh-huh.
And so I wonder if there was possibly, by certain politicians, some effort to not have,
right,
information go out to the people.
Right, right.
In their area, perhaps. Because not only did I not hear, but I don't think my in-laws, who were voting in that election,
right,
got that information.
So there are issues of limited coverage, and then there are questions about verification. How do you verify what data are accurate and which ones are either knowingly trying to distort or just aren't right?
Sure. I would also just add to that, just because it's similar, is also the companies, the messaging companies themselves, how much can you really trust them? in the sense that, say, like, probably in past recent things, they're very trustworthy.
Right.
But, you know, even Google has proven itself not to be trustworthy.
Right.
And, you know, that's something
yeah.
that
Yeah, no, that's a great question, too. I mean, they are getting information through different means. And some of them, the predominant one is text messaging. But in, as we'll see in the Horn of Africa, they're using ham radio communications. And obviously there are people with cell phones who just call and explain what's going on. Again, the question is verification. And how do you verify what is accurate and what is not? A great example, though, of a cell phone company that did kind of the opposite of what you were just saying, George, was in the Kenyan election cycle. The CEO of the cell phone company, at least one of the predominant ones in Kenya, I think it's called Safaricom, or some. It's I believe that's the name of it. He was asked whether he would shut his cell phone company down during the election because they were afraid that there would be incitement to violence, and so he came out with a text message to all the Safaricom users that if anybody used Safaricom to foment violence or to encourage bribery or anything like that, that Safaricom would prosecute. So there you go back to the Horowitz framework about increasing the risk rather than reducing the risk of getting involved in this sort of thing. Again, I mean, we have no idea how effective that was, but it's noteworthy that he tried to do something like that. But we'll get in. I've got another one here. Let's see. Verification. So this goes directly back to the question that you're talking about. The first way that you verify data is manually. The nice thing about text messages is what? What?
It's real time.
Instant. Well, it's real time, but what else?
Traceable.
Not only is it traceable, but you've got their phone number, right? So you can literally just call them back up and ask them for more information. I mean, you just allege that somebody's bribing somebody, you know, in this neighborhood or in the slum area. We want to hear a little bit more about that, right? So that's fairly straightforward. Interestingly, in Sri Lanka, they had two retired police officers who did the verification, and what they did is they called their buddies in different police offices throughout Sri Lanka to find out what was really going on, which was really good, but sometimes it would take a day or two, which was problematic because it wasn't real time. Okay? The other way to do it is through automation, and these techniques are just now being used. Ushahidi, you can see on their website if you go to it, they've got something called Swift River. And what they do with Swift River is that they rank a source. If you find out that somebody is sending in bogus information, that individual is completely discredited. Their multiplier becomes zero. Every event that they send in, their multiplier is zero. Okay? And then proximity to the event. Okay, somebody's reporting on something that's happening over here in another province. I don't think that's really a good indicator of accuracy, right? And then the other one is corroboration with other reports. So they're developing a mathematical way to, and it's quick. I mean, that's the thing, the mathematics are quick, a lot quicker than a manual approach. Is it perfect? No, it probably isn't. But it's interesting, these people are really inventive. Sometimes I wonder about, you know, computer programs and all the computer programmers, and all due respect, George, they come up with these names. Like, have you ever been there and all of a sudden the computer says that it's exchanging a cookie? Where did they come up with cookie? I never got that one, right? So what the name that these people call this one is the digital straw. Because the data typically is increasing in speed and volume. When people start finding out about this, there are a lot of viral emails and more people start jumping into it. You had 1,000 emails, you know, an hour ago, and now you're getting tens of thousands, and it just starts mounting. Because people want, you know, it's kind of like, there's not a lot of pain involved, and you can participate in something that you think might make things better. So they just start jumping on the bandwagon, and you might also get, you know, the, what's the name of the BJP militant group? There's a militant group that's illegal that the BJP works with.
Yeah,
I can't remember the name
I
of
know
it.
The BJP.
Yeah.
My husband's more of a politician.
Okay. Anyway, if they start using it, then you've got a real big problem. So they start sending out email messages to people, you know, jump onto the website, Vote India website. So it grows in a phenomenal way. They've created this thing called the digital straw. They're using these three ways of testing whether it's, you know, this mathematical verification, and they're developing a peer review one, not unlike Wikipedia, which I think is fascinating. It's a peer review system. So people can go onto a digital map, and it will have like a question mark near the event. You'll see in just a little bit. You click on where the events are at on a map. You can blow up the map that's there. You click on an event. And it might have a little flag on it that's, I don't know, pink, which means it's not verified yet. And then you can go on, and if you think that if you saw that this event was actually happened, you click on green. If you don't know, you click on yellow. If you know that it's false, you click on red. So it's a peer review system. And so what happens is, as more and more red ratings, kind of like when you rate somebody on eBay, or when you rate the accuracy of an article on Wikipedia, then Wikipedia puts up, we're not sure about the content here, or eBay says, don't trust this vendor, right? What Yoshihide does is, the data that had been posted by somebody that gets a lot of red votes vanishes from the map. So it's really, it's kind of an interesting application of a peer review process for purposes of verification. So these are the three kinds of data verification that they're starting to use. And the group that I worked with in Sri Lanka, Foundation for Coexistence, it was manual only. They had no other approach. But keep in mind that some of these early warning for violence things, they train staff members and send them out into the field. Call them field officers usually. So there's a difference between crowdsourcing and what they call bounded crowdsourcing. Bounded crowdsourcing is when you send trained people out into the field and you add their data to the data being sent in from the crowd. Okay? And so and sometimes what they do is they'll have a field officer out there, somebody they train, somebody they believe is highly reliable. They'll say, hey, there's been an allegation that there was, you know, a lot of, there was liquor distributed in a slum over here to get people to go vote for a certain candidate. Can you go check that out? And that's exactly what they do. They'll go over there and they'll check it out. And so they get fairly quick on the ground, not real time, but you know, there might be an hour delay or whatever, but they get verification quickly. Yes?
Who was they again? Was it like Swift River organization or an NGO? Or
Yoshihide. It's often, they call them, it's a real awkward acronym, VNTC. VNTC, which stands for Volunteer and Technical Community. So it's basically VNTC. So basically what you get the activists here, and you get the computer nerds here. And they form a community. I'm sorry, George, I don't mean to downplay the computer. But basically you get these young people who, you know, they grow up, you know, with a, you know, an iPhone attached to their umbilical cord.
Yeah.
Right? When they know technology so well, it's unbelievable. So they, you know, they come up with stuff like Swift River. You know, the digital straw. So they form, usually they're a bunch of volunteers. I mean, it's unbelievable. I was at a conference in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the kind of the leader of this Tufts University Stanford group that was involved with the kind of the rolling out of Yoshihide for the Haiti relief operation, they were in touch with the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs of the United Nations. you know, it's the one that kind of coordinates the humanitarian intervention of different things. And the people from, it's called OCHA, Office of the Humanitarian Affairs, Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, it's a UN organization. They asked this volunteer and technical community, the person's name is Patrick Meyer, who's kind of the, you know, what can I say, the ringleader. They asked them, they invited them to create a digital map for Libya. So during this conference in Cambridge, the digital map went live. And all these people, they were staying up all night to get this thing ready to go. And they had contacted people in Libya through internet exchanges, and a lot of people don't know this, but this is a really fascinating thing when it comes to understanding global solidarity and how all of this is starting to, in a way, shrink the world. And I don't mean to be, you know, overly optimistic about what technology can do, because there are certainly severe limitations. But the young people who were involved in overthrowing Milosevic in Serbia, and the young people who were involved in overthrowing the dictator in Tunisia, many of them went into Egypt to help them with their effort. And so you've got this international solidarity. So it's no surprise to me that, you know, if you go back to the map, Egypt's here, Tunisia's here, Libya's in between. These young people know who's at the, in a sense, the vanguard of trying to make things happen. The sad thing is, and you know, I don't want to get too far ahead of examples, the sad thing is that a lot of people think that social media and digital mapping and text messaging is kind of a magical sort of technology. And they forget the fact that it requires strategy and organizing to really make things happen. There was strategy and organizing in Egypt and in Tunisia. They planned this for years. They were downloading a Gene Sharp text. Gene Sharp is kind of a real practical, he's a Harvard professor that's retired now, and he's been putting all of his books up on the internet for free. And a bunch of young people in the Middle East have been translating them into Arabic and getting them all over the place, and they're the ones who are at the vanguard in Tunisia and Egypt. Yeah.
Is this technology being used for mediational stuff? Jimmy Carter came to mind as far as face-to-face type of thing without digital verification. I'm thinking about the FARC in Colombia.
Right.
Guerrilla groups versus governmental groups.
Right.
The mediational process between the violent prevention. Does it have anything to do with, has it evolved to other countries like that?
Well, it's being used in other countries. It's a real good question. It's being used more for social movements designed for either preventing violence or for enhancing emergency response to disasters, and less for macro political conflict resolution.
What went through my mind was the many, many, many hostages and kidnappings that have been done by the FARC.
Right.
Fuerzas Armadas, Colombia.
Right.
And where do you find these people? And if there was a technology to click on a sighting and deliver it to a nexus like this, it would really be really,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, no, that's right. That's right. I'll try to pull up the map from Haiti here in a little bit, but that's right. I mean, I can see how it could really be helpful, particularly as it relates to compliance to an agreement. You know, because you can keep track of what's going on much better, with much greater ease. In fact, in Darfur, yeah.
I was going to say, the problem, it's a good idea, but at least with the FARC in particular, they tend to keep people out in the jungles.
Yeah.
So there wouldn't be too much of sightings in that case.
But
the whole idea of using cell phones,
right,
really does have power. Because even the remotest villages nowadays,
right,
in many countries have.
Right.
Has cell phones.
And like I said, in Africa, they're starting to use radios, which helps. But it's kind of like I mean, just imagine, if you can imagine the challenge of keeping track of what's going on, it's like you've got this information barrage, and you're trying to keep track of what's going on. To a large extent, that's what the digital mapping is useful for. You've got this barrage of text messages. You've got reports coming in from your field officers. In other words, when we talk about bounded crowdsourcing or with Foundation for Coexistence, they didn't use crowdsourcing. Every field officer had to send in a report every day. That's how they kept track of what was going on. The text messaging technology, the Ushahidi thing, hadn't been developed yet. But that's a really good question. I suspect it could be useful for the macro level negotiations. Okay, so I don't know if any of you remember Rod Stewart's album, Every Picture Tells a Story, Don't It? It was a great song, it was a great album, it was my sister's favorite. So I had to put this up here. Okay, so what the thing that you've got to remember is every picture does tell a story. Well, how do you get a picture of what's going on? You put it on a map, right? And if you want to drill down to use the terminology of, you know, of what some of these volunteer and technical communities, if you want to drill down, you click on the map and you get less aggregated information. You get more of the detail. Okay? So you keep clicking down, oh, okay, here's the slum, here's where the liquor was being distributed to get people to go vote for a specific candidate. You can also go there, and if somebody's got a video camera on their cell phone, you can get a film of it. Amazing, right? Absolutely amazing. Okay, so here's the image that I want to convey. Remember when you see those World War II movies and you see these generals standing around in the room and they're pushing around their little toys on their piece of plywood, right? Here's the ocean, here's the land, we're playing the Normandy invasion. Oh, here, we'll move some ships over here. How about these tanks? They're all smoking pipes, right? They're all men. They've got their sleeves up, they're working hard. Ushahidi does that for people dealing with humanitarian relief. They don't need the plywood anymore, right? They don't need the little toys anymore. They don't even need the pipes anymore. They just put it up onto a digital map. And then, and there are some organizations, and this one in particular is this group in Philadelphia taught me a lot about this. They're called Hunch Lab is what they're called now. It used to be called the Crime Spike Detector, but they allow police officers to interrogate the data. Now, this was a new one for me. Okay, you know, I'm imagining a Gestapo camera, right? Interrogation. No, they interrogate the data. And what's fascinating about this is that they get crime data, and they're trying to figure out when is it, you know, there have been rumors that there's going to be a gang war taking place in this neighborhood, what's going on? So they're pulling together crime data, and then they start importing things like sale of guns, sale of ammunition, right? And they look at there might be car thefts and, you know, all kinds of different things where people are going to want to before a gang incident, they're going to want to escape in cars that the license number isn't the one on their car. Right? So they start pulling the pieces together and they interrogate the data. In the Horn of Africa, some of the researchers, including Patrick Meyer, the leader, what I would call the leader of these volunteer technical communities, in the Horn of Africa, they found that environmental data was really helpful. So you've got this violence between pastoralist tribes there. You're trying to minimize the violence between different pastoralist tribes, and you start figuring out, oh, the rainfall over in this area has really been bad. They don't have enough fodder for their cattle. Okay? They found that, so they were able to interrogate data that way, not in the same way that they do in Philadelphia, but they found that you start commingling data. And the people in Philadelphia, they start looking at where the liquor stores are at, where a drug sale was. You know, they combine all kinds of different information and they interrogate it. And one of the key things that I want to help you with here to remember is that, and you'll see, there are mathematical approaches to try to identify where something is going to happen before it happens. It's called pattern recognition. We're going to get into that. But never lose sight of the fact that the human mind is an incredible, it's better than a computer, it's better than artificial intelligence. Human induction is far superior. So if you've got humans, like police officers, who can interrogate data from their cars to try to anticipate a gang war, and they get good at interrogating the data, and then they call some of their friends and they say, did you hear this, did you hear that on the radio or whatever, they can put two and two together better than computers can. That's something never to, you know, that's clear to me after I've seen all these different systems. Mathematics are great, but they have a limit. The only problem that human induction can have are problems of what social scientists, computer scientists call collective intelligence. So groupthink can be a problem, et cetera. So I'm just saying that keep in mind that the human mind has a great deal to offer here. It's not all about computers. Now here's an example of pattern recognition. And how does a moving average work? You may have seen the output charts of electricity for Holden from the power plant here as it relates to the snow on the bulletin board. Okay, so those are plotting the amount of electricity that actually occurred during those months, right? What does a plot of a moving average look like? Here's an example of a 3-week moving average of the amount of violence. Because what a lot of these systems do to get an early warning is that they add together the violent incidents, and that's a function of the weight of those incidents, right? So it's the number of incidents and the weight of those incidents collectively. And what they're trying to figure out, the way that they're using to anticipate violence, is by seeing what is an unusual change, a relatively abrupt change. So a 3-week moving average, how would that work mathematically? Anybody? What's that?
You average the last 3 weeks, and each week you take off the previous week and add the new week.
So what you do is you add the last 3 weeks and divide it by 3, right? And so that's the number that you get. So it's kind of got what some people would call a smooth function. It smooths out rather than, you know, real erratic. It smooths it out. Okay, so you've got 3-week moving average. So let's just say that you've got, in one month you've got 20, the next month you've got, or the next week you've got 30, or the next day, depending on how you're breaking it down, the next day you've got 40. You add that together, and then you divide that by 3. That's the value that you give for that point in time. The next point in time, you drop off the 20 and add the new time interval. Do you understand what I'm saying?
If you're doing it by weeks, you could do it by days.
You could do it by days. You can even do it by hours if you have those data.
Yeah.
So it just depends on what your data are. And so an example, and this is one from the Philadelphia group. The Philadelphia people taught me this. They start out 3-week moving average compared to 5-week moving average. And then, not to get too elaborate here, but if you remember a normal distribution based on probability theory, right? One standard deviation on both sides of the average, the mean, constitutes about 68% of all the cases. It's a mathematical way of determining what's kind of normal versus what isn't normal, okay? So here, you can barely see it on with the light here, but you can see we plotted the standard deviation here. It's the dark area. You see what I mean? Up here, the five-week moving average went beyond the standard deviation. We've got it blown up right there. So in Philadelphia, when something like that happens in a specific police precinct, the Hunch Lab system that they've created automatically sends an email to those police officers warning it looks like something's going to happen. I just think that's fascinating. So they've programmed it. What they're trying to figure out is, in a probabilistic way, is violence going to happen? And if so, should we alert people? And so the Philadelphia police sergeants, they usually allocate more police officers to those areas that have gotten a warning.
Isn't that a trailing warning, though? If it's already spiked out of standard deviation, isn't that trailing?
Well, what you can say is, that's a really good question. Maybe this should say, it might be better to say amount of tension. In other words, tension is building. Something unusual is happening. It's not intended to be an ex post facto thing. It's supposed to be something that gives them a warning before it happens.
So it's probably not the trending of violence so much as, like you said earlier,
the tension.
The buying of guns,
It could be that. Yeah. Cars. And they get better, you know, they're getting better and better in identifying what kinds of factors, you know, fit into this, and you know, some of them are, you know, whiz kids on statistics, and they're using, you know, multiple regression and all of that. But it's basically relatively simple. They're adding together different indicators of tension, some of which might be violence. Like, let's say that let's say you're in California, the Crips beat up one of the Bloods. Okay, so that was violence. It's not a gang war, but that's weighted heavily. And something like that could move it outside of the standard deviation. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Because it's weighted so heavily. Because it's symbolic. A little bit like what we talked about before as being a precipitating event.
So, and all that together would help officers to, you know, go with their sources to find out, you know, human intelligence to verify, you know, whether something is going to happen.
Right.
So,
that's right. And then ideally, you know, going back to the Jimmy Carter mediation thing, you have people who go in, and we'll talk a little bit more about the ceasefire group in Chicago, but they hire former gang members to go in and intervene with the gang leaders to talk them out of the gang war.
One of the things, like with like intelligence-led policing or data-led policing, like they, with mapping, they do mapping of, like, say, property crime type of things, like car clouts or car thefts or burglaries, and they'll map it, and then they'll put hot spots, and those will be like in red. And so, like you said, police patrol resources will be concentrated in those areas, and then an increase of amount of person stops and things like that. And they'll also look at predicting times that these are happening, and so they'll allocate resources for certain times of the day or night.
Okay.
When those are happening too.
That's fantastic.
And so they'll actually, the maps will be produced that will have, you know, where the hot spots are or emerging hot spots that are showing some new trends coming. And like you said, some of that is a little bit stale, but then it oftentimes with property crimes, there'll be someone living in a certain area that will start doing a rash of burglaries in a certain area where they happen to be flopping or staying.
Okay.
And doing that. And so it it often becomes useful. And then it's combined also with working known people who have been contacted and maybe out at night in that area with at 3 a.m. wearing a hooded sweatshirt on a 40-year-old male that has a past history of burglaries and car clouts and riding a little BMX bike, you know.
What's going on here? You know
that these people are contacted, and so you know you work people and you work, try and contact them, knowing where they live, doing knock and talks, things like that.
That's
so, so it's a new trend where, you know, it used to be like the big thing of policing used to be community policing.
Uh-huh.
And now it's more going towards this trend, using data to make make police agencies more efficient in the use of their time, and especially with shrinking resources.
That's really interesting. I mean, what it boils down to, those of you who come from a business background, it's like a management information system for the police department. It really helps them maximize their resources to achieve a certain goal. The same is true for people who are attempting to prevent violence in developing countries, people who are attempting to use this kind of system to have a more effective humanitarian relief operation, or the same as people trying to bring about political transformation nonviolent. I mean, it is a technology that is developing. And I'm really happy that you brought this up. Another thing I want to mention, the 40-year-old with the hood over his head riding a little bike, the little BMX bike. What a great piece of data, right?
Oh, sure it is. Well, it's like a reason to, like, that person is up to no earthly good.
Yeah, I mean, red flag, right? All over the place. So this 40-year-old is riding a little kid's bike, right? Mm-hmm. So this is a great example of how sometimes you have to look for data that might not otherwise be obvious. Okay? Let me give you another example. I was at a futures conference in England one time, and one of the people at this conference, he was talking about, you know, people get upset because there are no data. Sometimes you have to look a little bit deeper to identify what the data are really there. In this case, you've got, if there's a 40-year-old person riding down the road with their hood up and they're riding a little kid's bike, that's got a weight of about 100 on it, mm-hmm. right?
As far as generating a reason to look for it, to stop and talk to them.
Stop and talk, right, mm-hmm. right. Whereas this person in England, I thought this was fascinating, he said, you know what some of the best data is for anticipating when the United States is about ready to do a military strike? Mm-hmm. The number of pizza trucks going to the Pentagon at night.
That's nothing new.
What a great example. And it's true. Okay.
I have spies watching
Pizza
Hut. Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Speaking of, you just got to get into the South parking lot. That's all.
Yes.
One thing that was, considering what's happening in England right now, and the desire to get information by whatever means, mm-hmm. I see a possible hazard with hacking and getting that type of information. How do you think that can be dealt with?
I think that right now the whole problem of use for good reasons and abuse for nefarious reasons is still being worked out. I mean, yeah. it's a big challenge because you've got a lot of this stuff that's going on. You know, you've got crowdsourcing, and you get infiltrators who, you know, start sending in false information, or they're anticipating, oh, they think it's going to be violent over there. Let's go up here and hope you're more successful.
Just thinking, the police department, the good guys,
right?
Using the bad way to get the good information to prevent crime,
right?
And how that impinges on human rights and rights to privacy. That's
right. Well, the good thing is that, and this is something that Patrick Meyer wrote in one of his blogs, seemingly the bad guys are usually organized like FBI, CIA types. And mm-hmm. Not that these are bad people, but in our country, I mean, I think many of them are good people. But in a lot of countries, these are kind of sinister, you know what I'm saying, sinister yeah. individuals who are, they're like official sabotage people, right? Official arms of oppression.
Yeah.
Usually, and this is something that Patrick Meyer wrote, I thought was really insightful, usually these people are one or two steps behind the little kids who get born with an iPhone on their umbilical cord. They're just not there. At least right now they're not. They just don't understand it.
Interesting.
Yeah. Let me, before we've got to stop, we've got 5 minutes, let me show you something here. We got into some of this, and we'll get back to it. But let me just show you a couple things that I think will be of interest. First of all, this is the actual data from Sri Lanka. As you probably know, this is the acronym for the Tamil Tigers Liberation, Tamil Tigers of Elan, LTTE. So what you had, the main event was this, use of force, an attempt at a coup. It was an ethnic organization. This was the group, and this is the amount of injuries and deaths. Okay? So from 2003 to 2008, they had over 24,000 incidents. And this was not from crowdsourcing. This was from their officers, their field officers, who are actually out in the field. Now, and also they had people looking at newspaper articles, listening to radios, and in Sinhalese, in Tamil, and so they accumulated all of these data. Let me go back to. I want to come back to this, but just real quickly. Okay, we talked about this last night at the forum, those of you who were here. I'm sorry, I've probably been eating bandwidth here at Holden Village because they don't have very much bandwidth. I couldn't get it completely downloaded before our session. But as you can see, this is the map of Haiti, the earthquake response. These are the number of events that they have in there. What you can do, it's still downloading, so I doubt if I can do this. You can click on, City Soleil. That's a very gang-infested part of Port-au-Prince. And you could click on it and find out what the incidents are. Let me scroll down. These are the different incidents that they had. These are the categories. Now, there may be subcategories in each of these, but you can see public health. Okay, where do you go to get a hospital? As we talked about last night, a lot of people needed amputations. Where do you go get an amputation? It was being posted here, and then people would, even though a lot of the Haitians didn't have access to the internet, their relatives living outside of Haiti or their friends did, and then they called their friends and relatives and told them where they could get a hospital, where they could go to the hospital, where they could get food, where they could get water. So this is an example, and I'm going to get out of it because I'm eating up Holden Village's bandwidth here, but it's an example, if you can see, remember, the plywood, the toys, and the pipes, no longer needed. Digital maps. Incredible.
What's the most micro level that this can be useful? Could it be used for, a event, like a protest rally? Or something?
Oh, yeah, like yeah, they're using it for that. And then they're posting the video, Let's say, in particular, if there's a protest rally and there's hate speech, mm-hmm. oftentimes these people, depends on the sophistication of their cell phones, mm-hmm. but sometimes they can get short video. And they'll send that in and post it. And then Yushahidi will post it. Now, I want to stop here, and I want people just to reflect for a little bit. I'm going to go to the bottom of this database. See here on the far right, you see ambiguous versus credible? That was their verification determination, okay? I'm going to go to the very bottom of it. ...22,000 people died over that period that these field officers were aware of or witnessed. So keep Sri Lanka in your prayers, please. Thank you very much.